Ross, to me, epitomizes what this program is about. He's probably, in my opinion, my, after me being the head cheerleader for OA, I think Ross could probably, you know, wear the skirt and do the pom-poms fairly well. And I'm really glad and really happy that he's here today to share his story with us. So without further ado, I'd like to call up Ross, who is our main speaker. This one. And you are being recorded.
Hi, I'm Ross, a very grateful compulsive overeater. You know, I had these great plans that I've been saying I am a grateful compulsive overeater. I had a grateful several years ago, but I've been saying it and it kind of rolls off. And I was thinking about it, and I haven't been a main speaker a lot. This may be my third time, so this was a great honor. And being I'm on the committee, I was asked, so I didn't solicit myself. But it's so special for me to speak here. And I was thinking I wanted to do something different. A lot of you know me, a lot of you have heard me. And I wanted to change how I describe myself when I say, hi, I'm Ross. And I had this whole thing. And I was sitting there and I was saying, I'm a very grateful compulsive overeater, it just rolls off. And this is a little difficult to say, so I think I'm going to just do what is comfortable for me. But I'm going to tell you what I was going to say. I'll say it a little slow for me, because not that the word is that hard to say, but hi, I'm Ross. I am an incurable compulsive overeater. And as I go on with my qualification, I will, I hope I make that clear. And I think that actually looks like I got like three extra minutes, thanks, man, to speak. But as I will, you know, what I will try and do is try and take you, you know, like, you know, in progression and start from the beginning. So I will start at age 17. At age 17, I was overweight. I was, I believe, a junior in high school. I was a little older, and I was a junior in high school. And I was close to, you know what? Before I do that, I'm going to go back. And it was important for me when I first came into the program to hear other people. I needed to see other people because my concept, my diet concept, was in a certain amount of time I was on that diet, and then other things happened. But so I had that concept, and I knew one thing. I knew it was getting very difficult for me to diet when I walked in. The length of time it was, so I needed to hear it. So, you know, that's what I'm going to do. You know, I'm Ross. You know, I'm compulsive, and you know, I'm grateful. Now you know, I'm incurable. But I will tell you, through the grace of God, one day at a time, the Tuesday after Labor Day, I celebrated 30 years of abstinence. And I don't have an exact date on this, but very close to the end of the year, in 1980, one day at a time, hopefully, God willing, I will be celebrating maintaining approximately 75 pounds of weight loss. So there I was at 17. I was certainly not at my highest weight, but I was probably, you know, 50 or so pounds more than I am now. And it was difficult for me to be in high school and to look the way I looked. And, you know, I was picked on. But I developed something then. I developed a mechanism to pick on myself first, to make fun of myself first. I was kind of putting myself first, but not in a way that, you know, I do now. And I was unhappy. So at 17, my mother took me to a diet doctor. Back then, they were into amphetamines, aka diet pills. And that's what happened. I got a diet. He weighed me. I don't remember what he said, and he gave me the pills. And you know, I always say God kind of, being such a compulsive personality, and I have done other things in my life compulsively, such as smoke pot, such as drink, that I took the pills, and I went into sun fishing or something. I had an extreme allergic reaction to them, and I almost wound up in the hospital. So at that point, you know, the doctor took me off the pills, which was good. So at 17, it was, you know, not realizing how compulsive I was, God kind of took care of me. I didn't realize it, and I wasn't on the pills. But what I was on was, I had a policeman. I had somebody, in addition to my mother, who was paying for this doctor to lose the weight for. And that began a diet career when I always seemed to be doing this for them, for somebody else, for in the family, for whoever. But I never really was doing it for the person who mattered the most, me. A couple years in the program, I was abstaining, I was speaking, and I don't remember who was an anniversary, but my late mother, I asked her to come, and I was qualifying, and I said exactly what I was saying, but I used the term, I said, my mother dragged me to a diet doctor, and that's how I stopped. And thank God she didn't jump up during the middle of the meeting and correct me. She didn't. After the meeting, she came to me, she goes, Russ, this was a long time from, this was probably like 15, 16 years from when it happened. And she goes, Russ, I didn't drag you, you begged me. I had completely taken that out. So I was that unhappy, and I put 14 years of compulsive overeating. I have no doubt before I was 17, I ate compulsively. I have no doubt. I was always husky. I always was a little big. And I too am from an Italian American. We were a little, I think my family was mostly from Brooklyn, so I think we were a little more Americanized. So we really didn't eat that much traditional, but we just ate. And, you know, and probably every culture has the eating part, and we all share that. And so I'm sure I ate compulsively before, as I said, but 17 is what I remember, and I was 31 years old when I came in the program. A lot of stuff happened in between. I became a career dieter. I truly do believe, and probably my top weight during that time, from 17 to 31, was probably 90, 95 pounds from what I am now. I never looked, you know, I was always on a diet, and I truly believe if I wasn't in the diet world, wars, if I wasn't fighting it, I don't know where it would. I really don't know where it would end. I was morbidly obese when I was at my highest weight or close to my highest weight. I'm sure I would have surpassed that. But I always was fighting it. I always was battling it. And there was one still around, a very famous weight-losing organization. I went to that. I went to another one that's not there anymore. And, you know, when I did it, I always would try to go with people. That was another thing. Can you hear me? It was too close?
No.
Is it better?
Yes.
Don't
take
you on. Just talk.
Now I did. You know, I noticed this being taped. I just showed how unprofessional we were. You know, to have a little sound test in the middle of it. Now where was I? Well, I think I know where I was. So I was battling it, but it was always too. It was progression that I was, you know, always with people, and again doing it for people. And you know what I did get used to, and what I see now, and you know, there was always women. It always seems, you know, that I was always in a minority when I walked in, as far as, you know, there weren't that many men. But it really didn't matter. And at times I was successful in those organizations. But I learned something. I got what they call goal weights or target weights, and I would always stop short, 20 or 30. At my most successful diet, I would always stop at 20 or 30 pounds from my, well, I call it a normal weight now. It was called the goal weight then. So I would always stop. There was a reason that I would always stop. And I didn't find out that reason until I started to do moral inventories, which we call the fourth step. And I found out later that I was holding on to that surplus of weight, because that was my scapegoat for life. That was the thing that I blamed. Everything wrong in my life, I was fat. If you didn't like me, it was because I was fat. If you didn't go out with me, it was because I was fat. If I didn't get that promotion, it was because I was fat. Well, I'm jumping ahead. I got to a normal weight in this program. Guess what? There were people who still didn't like me. There were people who still won't go out with me. And I didn't get that promotion. Well, what's left? You. So that scapegoat eventually came off, but a lot led to it. In addition to the groups that I was in, I would participate in fad diets. And I remember one that you could only be on it 2 weeks, because the fruit you ate was so acidic, I guess it would rot your neck or something. So, I mean, there were like some that were very unhealthy. And then I went into the one meal a day, and a two meal a day, and a no meal a day. And then I heard about fasting, and I tried that. And then the greatest one, it wasn't great, the one I could manipulate the most was calorie counting. I quickly found out, I'm going through great lengths not to mention food, but you'll know what it is, that I don't remember the calories. You know, I'm guessing 1,600. I'm really guessing. But I knew that my first two meals were like normal kind of diet meals, and they were like a 500 or 600 calories, something like that. Whatever it was, I would always have, it seems, 1,000 calories left. In a 3/4 pound bag of these things that have a shell with letters on them is about 1,000 calories. So what it turned out to be, it would be two diet meats and just a whole bunch of sugar for dinner. And I learned to the addictive power that sugar has over me. This is a good time to give you, I knew I'd jump around, but I'll get you there. Good time to give you my, I feel very strongly about having a very, very strong, definitive, this is me, for me, a strong, definitive definition of abstinence. Because we have a very, we have something that kind of tells us that we're really not that bad. So I needed something, for me, I needed, and we have something, I'm not using the word what we have, I'll get into that later, that is gray at times. And we have to eat. So, for me, I had to have one that was I could look at. And my definition of abstinence is 3 weighed and measured meals a day. I abstain from sugar and white bread flour, and I take it one day at a time. Also, and if I have time, I'll tell you why, but I you know, sometimes when you get a definition of abstinence, the absolutes is what I'm talking about. You might want to put a bunch of stuff in there. And I know for me, I couldn't make it that thin. I couldn't I don't drink diet soda today. I don't use any artificial sweeteners. And we're talking probably close to 30 years on that. But it's not in my definition. But I know that if I did start that after all that time, we got problems. And the first composite bite is around the corner. I have, you know, somewhere in the program, something's not being worked right. And it really starts with me. Doesn't end with me, but it starts with me. So, being addicted to sugar, and really, I say white bread flour because that's what I was addicted to. I needed to know that. And, you know, when you start to find out what you are addicted to and you can work on it, and it's not easier, but it becomes more simple. You do or you don't. And for me, I need to have strict terms with abstinence. You are or you ain't. And there are words that are used that I always call diet mentality words. And being such a diet veteran, I used it in the past. I slipped. I can afford to. I've been good. I've been bad. And these words could be used today. For me, I need to not think about them. I can't concentrate on them because it would take away what this is. I need to have a very defined definition. It has to be there. So anyway, what was happening with this, a lot of things happened in my life. One of the things is I was married very young, had two children very young, got divorced, and for a few months I moved in with my mother, and she still thought I was, she still thought I was like, in my teens, and I knew I had to get out of there. I loved her very much. I moved back to my hometown, Bayonne, but I had to. And I learned of somebody who knew of somebody who was a roommate. I guess it's not the most wise, who had an apartment, was looking for a roommate. I knew the middle person, but I didn't know this person. Well, it turned out, and we did, and it turned out that this person, I say he did. I don't know if he ever admitted it, but he had a pretty bad drinking problem. And it was funny, during that year, my drinking went kind of awry, and it's funny too. I have told some of my drinking stories to people who are in both programs, and I remember on a couple occasions saying, Ross, maybe you belong in the other rooms too. And you know what? I might. But since that not having a drink, I have not drank for 29 and three quarters year, and I'll even explain why it's not 30 years. I have not had alcohol. And if I do, I am not absent. I am not in recovery. For me, it's a moot point. I mean, and truly, if my family does drink at home, if it ever really became it was calling me too loudly and I felt I needed to, I'd be there. I have no doubt in my mind. So, and then what happened was we had a difference of opinion, and not only could I not let my two young children sleep over, I couldn't have pictures in the living room. And I'm not a aggressive person, and back then, I'm better now, but I wasn't too assertive, and it takes a lot to motivate me. And I really wanted to live by myself, but I had strong fears, couldn't afford it. That was the motivation I needed. That I couldn't have pictures of my children in the common living room. So in a way, it kind of helped. And it got me into Ford's and New Jersey and into an apartment. And that was maybe 2 years or so before I walked into rooms. And the reason why I jump up to that is, we hear this a lot. You know what, I'm going to say this word, so I'll explain to it. When I came in the program, I had no problems with the word compulsive overeater. I had a problem with this word, and I could not say it for several meetings, because I didn't want to give what I do the power of this word, which was a disease. I do have a disease today. I had it then. And I still have that disease. And I'm just in remission one day at a time. So back to moving in by myself. And the reason why I went into the word disease is because I'm going to talk about progressiveness, being progressive. And I have a disease. I have to speak for myself. I forget sometimes. I have a disease that is progressive. A lot of things when I was eating, I was a secret eater. I ate by myself. I would be questioned by people who knew me, friends, and some distant family, you know, and they knew my weight problem. And see, I fluctuated in weight because I was always on some kind of diet. And I was always 30 or 40 pounds overweight, but sometimes I was 70 and sometimes I was 30. So I didn't even know what I would look like. I had the whole range of clothes, like a lot of us have. And so when I was by myself, that was my dream. I didn't have to hide eating anymore. So the compulsive overeating went crazy. And the weight came on, and what happened during those years that I was living by myself is the ability to diet was leaving me. In the beginning of the of my diet career, I could diet 2 and 3 months at a time. But then there was a month. And then it was like 2 weeks. And towards right before coming into the rooms, I couldn't string days together. I couldn't string them together. So, and some of my crazy eating stories was during that time, and I certainly remember, eating, not eating in the car, eating what dropped in the car a couple of weeks after, and I remember scraping out of a pan what was left that wasn't clean for 2 days. Again, I lived by myself. I remember taking my kids' food when it came for the weekend and not being there, buying for them and telling them I didn't buy it and lying and all that kind of. And then the thing that convinced me that I was the sickest person in the world. I was drinking, I was by myself at home and eating. And I was eating out of a box of snacks. And I must have ate before. I became so bloated and so sick feeling. I always would wake up in the morning thinking I had the flu. So it was really a reaction to the overeating. It was a hangover. And it was even when I didn't drink, I felt. So, I mean, you know, it was just eating would give me that feeling that I had the flu. I wasn't right. I didn't feel good. I didn't look good. And this happened. And I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't eat this. So I threw it away. Safe harbor. I fell asleep. An hour or two, I woke up, and it kept calling me, and it kept calling me. And I went into the garbage, and I took that food, and I started eating it. And as I was eating it, the esteem couldn't get lower. I called myself sick. You know, the self-hatred was insane. But I was still eating it because I couldn't stop. I remember in work, it got so bad. They were like in a movement to make Ross thin. And I wasn't the fattest guy there. It was always everybody, you know, I felt like I was persecuted. So I had to find a cafeteria in a different part of the building and where the vending machines were eating there. But then people saw me. So then I had to eat in the bathroom. But then I didn't want to just eat in the bathroom. I wanted to kind of eat when I walked. And we were in a refrigerated warehouse, so we had big, big pockets. So I would eat out of my pocket, but I wasn't too sanitary. I might have ate a couple lint and a couple staples too, and it didn't really matter. So, this guy made me so mad. He came up to me one day and he said, "Ross, I see the way you eat." What? I tried to guard that secret, but I guess, you know, being like 70 or 80 pounds overweight at the time, which I was, closest to my heaviest weight, and I was within 15 pounds of my heaviest weight when I walked in, I guess I couldn't hide it too well. And I'm telling you, that refrigerated jacket was about that long. Hit everything. Hit the big stomach, the big legs, the big crotch. Hit it all. I wasn't sick, but I did always walk out with it and take it home, even when it was night. So how did I hide that from you? But what a nerve. What a nerve. Now, I had started to date someone, and I liked her. And when I was in the attraction mode, I would lose weight. And I had. I was lost 30 or 40 pounds, so I was maybe only 40 or 50 pounds. Maybe it was 2 months before, because whatever it was, because I was close when I walked in the door. Whenever he did approach me, though, and I said, no thanks, I'm on a diet right now that's working. And it brings me to another story. I always felt the people in my life, and this is what became, I acknowledge this is a very dangerous defect for me, and it's complacency. And when I felt I had you, I didn't have to do anything anymore. I didn't have to lose the weight. I didn't have to look good. And family members had to love me. And it was the same thing. And I certainly did it through my first marriage, with the weight coming on after I was married. And I remember dating this person, and she said something bad to me. So again, 30 or 40 pounds. Again, I could be off a little on chronology, but 30 or 40 pounds overweight, and I still look pretty good, 30 or 40 pounds. And she stroked my stomach and said, I love a man with a pillow. I gave her two within like 2 weeks. I mean, a week. And I remember shortly after, I went to pick the kids up, and the mother of my kids said, she knew me. She looked at me, and she saw how quick the weight came back, and she said to me, I could tell you're dating someone, because I did it to her. So all this crazy kind of stuff. And by the way, when that guy came up to me, I didn't show how angry I was that he would come up to me, because this guy was a jerk. He had a stupid looking beard. He never looked clean, he looked unwashed, and he drank like a fish, I heard. And he comes to me. Well, I walked into the locker room at work, and what I would do a lot of times, I did this when I was very obese, I would seek the fattest person in the room with my eyes, so I didn't feel that bad. Misery loves company. So I would always do that. So that's what I did. I went up to this person who was probably 150 pounds overweight in the locker at work, and I said, you know, Andy, I truly believe that God has made some people. I use God. I got spiritual with him. I don't know if he thought I was nuts. I said, I truly believe God has made certain people to be fat. I included him. And we're two of them. And he looks at me, and he said, yeah, you're probably right. You know what that was? That was surrender. We talk about surrender in this program all the time. That's the good surrender. This was the bad surrender. Because what I was doing is I was surrendering to my compulsive overeater. I was surrendering to the disease. I was on the verge of not dieting anymore. I was on the verge of leaving the diet wars. I was ready to do that. And as I said before, who knows where I would be. I truly believe that this disease of compulsive overeating does everything that alcoholism and drug addiction does. I believe this is a life or death matter for those who say and believe that they have a disease of compulsive overeating. I believe this disease kills, but it's more accepted, to an extent. And not only is it more accepted, it is, the train of thought went, it'll come back. Oh, I'm sorry. It has different levels. In reading the big book, they talk about different types of alcoholics, and they talk about, you know, people who drink at special occasions to an excess. And then they talk about every day, but they don't lose their job. And there are different degrees. So you get to the one to where the person has lost everything. He's in the gutter. He's the town drunk. And I truly believe that happens with compulsive overeating. But it takes a lot longer. But it still has the same results. And the same feelings happen at that time. So that's where I was going when I told that person in the locker room that just God has made people, some people, to be obese, and there's nothing they could do about that. So that brings me back to this. I walked out of that, and I also gained a lot of weight very quickly, and at work, the obese guys had a diet bet. And it was the one who had lost the most weight, $1 a pound in a month, and blah, blah, blah. And at the time, we had scales, and they were scales that you would stand on, and the electronics, everything was much larger than it is now, so the readout was way large. And I remember midway through it, I just gave up. And I didn't care if I lost it, and I kept eating and eating and eating. And I got on a PIT scale, and with my freezer coat, I mean, it was almost at my top weight. It was within 10 pounds of it. I had probably 5 pounds of coat on, but I mean, it was there. And I think I was ridiculed, sure I was, but it didn't really matter because the job I was doing at myself, it reminded me of when I was in high school. It was just that self-hatred. So then, something happened. That guy, he didn't come up to me again. He never did. But I remembered what he said. And I went into, I got the phone book, and I just looked up Overeaters Anonymous, and there was a phone number in there. And I dialed the number, and there was an answer to my phone. It was no tape, it was a person. And they gave me a list of meetings, and they told me about a meeting in Island at St. Cecilia's. I said, okay. And I guess I went into work, and before I went to that meeting, I told Mike. I went to him, and he never brought it up to me again after he told me. And I said, Mike, I'm going to go to an OA meeting tonight. And he said, Ross, I don't know why. I didn't then. Would you like me to come with you? I said, no, that's okay. I'll go myself. And that statement was so different. I hadn't walked in the room, but I said something that I don't remember ever saying. I'll go myself. Well, that became for myself. And I walked in. Well, when I walked into the meeting, end of story, right? No, not really. I walk in, and at the time, and I hope they come back, there were huge meetings around. And there were two-hour meetings with breaks, sub-meetings, and I know there's a couple meetings around that have sub-meetings today, like small meetings, like beginner meetings or maintenance meetings before the main meeting. And this was one of them. And I would say they averaged probably more in this room a week, probably 50 or 60 people a week. And it wasn't even the biggest meeting. The biggest meeting was in Union at Connecticut Farms Church, and they had meetings sometimes that approached 100. This was a weekly meeting. So these were huge. So when I walked in, I kind of saw what I was used to seeing. Women. But then, I listened. And I started to hear about the food. And there was a food plan. There was a pamphlet on there. I'm glad gray and yellow were gone. Called Dignity of Choice. So they were there. And there was inspirational books and big books and the literature and stuff. So it had all that. But then they started talking about God. And at the time, meetings, I don't know if any meetings are doing it anymore, but most meetings back then ended in the Lord's Prayer. So, and it talked about God. And so like, and Serenity Prayer was said, so it was a prayer, there were prayers, there was God, He's going to do it, He's going to help you. And I had some friends who just became born again. And they were in, not the attraction phase, but they were in a promotion phase. And so they promoted it like I'm saying, oh my God, what did I walk into? A cult that makes you stop eating. A religious cult, the boot. So, but you know what? I needed something so badly, I kind of discounted that. So then I heard something else. I heard, get a sponsor. Get a sponsor, get a sponsor. We're going to have a break, and they asked for sponsors and all that available, or, you know, to raise your hand or to stand up. Or so, on the break time, I mustered all the courage I can, because I'm listening. I'm ready. I got to do something. I can't go on like this anymore. And I muster all the courage I have. And I went up to one of the few men at that meeting, and I said, excuse me, will you be my sponsor? It's nice. He said, no. I said, okay. I said, rejection. I get it out there every day. Nobody likes me. And now I come to this, like, everybody loves each other. And then, you know, the truth of the matter is I didn't pay attention to even if he was a sponsor, even if he was available or not. I didn't. So I said, and then I said, maybe this is all, you know, this is going on during this first meeting. I said, well, maybe, just maybe, I'll pick a pretty girl. I said, now let's go. And I did. And again, I don't know if she, I'm sure she didn't. And I just went up to her and I said, could you sponsor me? And she said, well, I have worked, you know, the requirements for the meeting, whatever it was, the sponsor, she had just completed them. Said, okay. So she said, what I want you to do, I did whatever she wanted. She goes, I want you to get the Dignity of Choice, pick a food plan, and then adhere to it and commit it to me. She wanted me to do that the first day, first meeting. So I did it. And I said, okay, I'm going to choose this. I don't know how detailed I was. And it was something I was familiar with, too. It was weighing and measuring. Because in the other organizations, I never did it, but it was on there. So I committed to do that. And so I said, okay, I'm going to give you my food. It was Tuesday night. Starting tomorrow, Wednesday. This starts Wednesday. And she accepted my commitment. It was Tuesday night. I don't start this diet, you know, because that's what I still thought it was, until Wednesday. I don't know if anybody have, well, I'm I'm going to try and be funny, anybody dieted in this room, but I don't know if anybody knows, when it comes to dieting, what the proverbial Last Supper is. Well, the Last Supper is this. It's the last binge, indulged, overeating, junk food eating thing you do before you start to diet. Because it does a couple things. Gets it out of your system, and it puts maybe a pound or two, because weighing is right before you start. So I did what I did many times. I went to the supermarket, and I truly did this. And I do remember my last binge. It was that. And I bought a lot of junk food. Well, it couldn't have been that much. I bought enough for that night. And then at the end of it, I would put two big bottles of diet soda. Because I knew that the checkout girl would say, look at this poor man who's fat. He's obviously on a diet. His family is eating all this junk food. I truly thought this. I'm not like, I did think this. And she goes, and he's on a diet because he is fat. There's his diet soda. And like she really cared. But I honestly, I would put the junk food first and the diet soda back there. I went home and I ate. I woke up in the morning and I began to follow my food plan. And began to weigh and measure. I've been doing it ever since. I've been weighing and measuring ever since also. There's a couple of things I do when I'm out at a restaurant or eating out. I measure and, you know, I do it with plates and I do it in a different way. But at home, it's the scale, measuring cup. And so I started that, and I didn't know why, and I still wasn't thinking disease, but it didn't matter. And so, like, so I remember weighing and measuring in front of my mother, and she says to me, now, I did it a few times, I brought the scales there, and she said, Ross, you know, I mean, they love you. They're Italians. They want you to eat, they want you to enjoy, but they don't want you fat, but they love you. She goes, I hate to see you a slave to these scales. And I said, Mom, I learned it's better to be a slave to that than to the food. I don't know if she understood. She also one time had to do this, and I've heard it so many times before I came in, but this she said while I was in program, and she must have said it, and we probably heard this from our loved ones before, especially since we start something, it starts to work, but then the family members, loved ones are starting to worry that you're deprived. So she said, Ross, can't you just cut down? By the time she asked me that, I knew the answer. Ma, there are certain things I can't cut down. All I can do is cut it out. And that's what I did. So I proceeded to, just work the program. I came up with a lot of, one thing. Remember Mike? I don't know if I gave his name. You know, the drunk with the long beard. I went up to him after I felt that this is something different. I'm going to try it with all my heart. I don't know why this moves me every time. And you probably know what I'm going to say. I said, Mike, how do you even know about it? He said, Ross, I'm an AA. And the reason why I break up is because I wound up working with his brother. I knew when, I left work in March, but I knew then he was still sober, living in Las Vegas. And so I certainly know he's 30 plus years. And his brother, we work program in a sense. Sometimes when we were kind of straying at work, we would bring each other down with program. And he's been sober for 25 years. So, I mean, and Mike was my Eskimo. I'll stop here. Does anybody not know the Eskimo story?
I don't know the Eskimo story.
You made me. Okay. Probably 100 years ago or so, there was the Yukon, frigid, desolate. There was a bar, and a missionary was working it. And there was a guy drinking. And all night, he told everybody that would listen, there is no God. There is no God. There is no God, there is no God, there is no God. The missionary was talking quietly to people in the back. He couldn't take it anymore. Couldn't take it. So he walked up to this, he said, how can you say there is no God? How do you know? He goes, I know. How? He goes, I'll tell you, Father. A few years ago, I took this sled out with the dogs, and it was the worst blizzard in the history of the Yukon. It was blinding. The dogs ran away. I was freezing. I felt I was dying. And I prayed, and I prayed, and I prayed to God to help me. And he never helped me. He ignored me. So the missionary looks like this and says, then why are you here? He goes, oh, well, some Eskimo took me and led me to the civilization. There's an Eskimo in our lives. Mike was my Eskimo. He planted the seed, he was there at the right time, and he let me do it myself. He did the exact thing. So a lot of times, we sometimes ignore Eskimos. I'm not saying he was the only one, but he's the only one that I listen to, thank God. So, here we are. I'm working program. I started to learn things. So, I also learned something that, Finn isn't well. It's not everything. I remember I had lost my weight, and I went to a singles dance, and I went up to the first person. I was wearing jeans for probably 25 years. They were designer jeans with a name in the back. And I went up, and I asked somebody to dance, and they said no. Well, I found a wall, and that's where I was all night, and I said, rejection. And so, it was like, and that's a case in point. It's more or less the person that liked to dance with me, whatever reason, but it was to where, again, my expectations were, once I lost the weight, that was the end game, that was it. Well, it isn't. So it is something that, it's a constant effort. And, I truly do believe that we can't work this program perfectly. But for me, there is one step I need to do perfectly every day, and that's take the first step. I have to truly believe I am powerless over food. I have to truly believe my life becomes unmanageable with food, and I need to say it and believe it 100% every day. Other things I've learned. There is recovery after relapse. I separated when I call myself judgmental. Judge, space, mental. So I was judgmental. And, I didn't lose the judging when I walked in. And, but I began to see that this is the only place you can get recovery. And, when I had became abstinent, lost my weight, I was rigid. And a lot of people who know me say, you're still rigid. Well, maybe so. But I couldn't understand, people who were just coming back and leaving and coming back and leaving because, and yet, who's to know if 2 years before, and I did hear about OA, my sister had mentioned it to me a couple years before, if I walked in and I would be the same way. So I know that unless you're at the bus depot, you're not going to catch the bus. So for people who are struggling, the answer is here. And if you ever, ever want to read the most inspiring story on relapse and recovery, pick up the Overeaters Anonymous Brown Book, the handbook, and read the first personal story. It's the story of Roseanne, our co-founder. So, I mean, and I recently read it, and it's an amazing story, and that's what great, that is what is great about this program. We don't exclude anyone. Also, I've learned, too, I remember one into my judging phase, I went to an East Coast Conference convention, otherwise known, I know there are a few people here, the Concord that went, yeah. I think I went the next year of coming in. And I was in this huge audience, and at the time there was 2,000 OAers here. It was huge. And on it, in the theater is where we would meet, and on the DS there were people who were going to be the main speakers. And there was one person who, I'm looking at him, and he goes, he looks kind of flabby, and he looks kind of fat, and he looks like he's maybe 80, 90 pounds overweight. And, you know, I start to really judge and say, well, I think he's about 270 pounds and 250. And like, so I'm saying, can't they pick somebody better? You know, they is us, by the way. We are OA. So I said, of course, he introduced himself. You know what I'm probably going to say. I'm currently maintaining a 400-pound weight loss. So this was a 650-pound man I was looking at. And there I am judging. So that was a lesson. We get a lot of lessons in this program. I mentioned that I am keeping an eye. I mentioned about maintenance. And I mentioned about not drinking for like 29 and three-quarters years. And so why, Ross, did you drink anything while you were abstinent? And also pot, too. Why would you smoke pot? Well, because I didn't know any better. And at the time, there were a lot of, you know, it wasn't only dignity of choice. There were food plans and things floating around. There was a maintenance plan around the rooms that allowed you to substitute fruit for wine. Hey, I like wine. Why not? So I remember doing it. And then, at that time, when I had lost the weight, it was something different I experienced. The weight loss started to increase towards the end. And it was funny, I'm driving this stuff. And so this is, 1981 maybe or something, and on the radio was a public service announcement, and it was on anorexia. It had to be one of the first. So when I got home, I had it. I had the anorexia, whatever that was. I had it, because the weight was coming off, and it was going below, and it was about to go below what my goal weight was. And so I called my sponsor and said, I got it. She goes, you got what? I go, I got the anorexia. She goes, where'd you hear that? I go, on the radio. I go, I think I'm not going to stop losing weight. She goes, Ross, hold it. Do you think if you started eating compulsively tomorrow, you won't put the weight back? Do you think for a minute? I go, no. She goes, you don't have anything. We will work on it. It's the time that you're going to approach maintenance. We're going to add some things. So she calmed me down. I got the anorexia. She calmed me down. And I did, and so I said, can I do this maintenance plan? She goes, I guess. Okay. So at the time I had quite a bit of fruit a day. So I substituted it, and then I learned what a spritzer was, where I could split it. I don't know what, and it was like a mathematical formula, and like, you know, and I remember, you know, I have a sit-down abstinence, by the way. Sit down. And there's sometimes at restaurants or some, but I mean, it's to where I sit down. It's And I remember going to a restaurant, and my fruit was, and I had it, and it was a length of time. And I said, gee, would I have done that with food? And I started to, you know, think, and then all of a sudden, I would have it. And then I remember it was calling me, and then, like, I remember taking a bottle and putting it down in the sink because I was afraid I was going to have it, not at mealtime, you know, but I could have it because I'm like, you know, I'm frenzied. So I went up to Sherry. And I said, Sherry, in 2 months, I'm going to go to a wedding, and like, I know they're going to have a cocktail hour, and I was thinking it might be a 20 or 30 minute, but if I take the spritzers and I move them here, and I've had the fruit, and I move it there, and I do, she goes, Ross. I go, what? How many times have you told me about this? First. She goes, the third. I never forget, Sherry looks at me. It's a beautiful woman. Sherry Reese, used her last name. And Sherry goes, I strongly suggest, that's like saying you better. That's how we talk. I strongly suggest you don't drink alcohol one day at a time. And that was 29 3/4 years ago. And in the course of me reading in a big book about mind-altering substances, I knew that I had to add smoking pot, because I think a couple times in the beginning of the program I did it, and I realized myself that would lead to the eating, and it was mind controlling. So they came in, and they'll never leave. Okay, so I am going to wind down, and I will say this: I enjoyed this memory lane I did with you. I came away with some core beliefs. Everybody may not agree with them. This is what I believe. As you know, I truly believe this is a life or death matter. I take my disease very seriously. Say it slow, because I treat this as my last recovery. Don't know if it is. I don't know if I ate compulsively after this meeting. Maybe in a day I would realize and go another 30 years of abstinence. Maybe it would take a week or a month or a year, or maybe I'll never have it. I treat it as it's my last one. You know, I remember in the beginning of program saying, I fear the first compulsive bite. I fear it. And somebody at the meeting came up to me and says, you cannot fear in this program because of God, because of your higher power. So I said, well, I got to come up with a better word. I have a healthy fear of the first compulsive bite. But then I was thinking, and it came up with a word that I've used almost from the beginning. I respect the first compulsive bite. I respect it like a flame. If I get close enough, I'll get warmth. I'll get light. But if I stick my hand in the middle of it, I'll burn it. So I respect the power of compulsive overeating. I respect it. Years ago, I was at a meeting, and somebody made a statement. I don't know if it changed my life in the sense that it maybe made me what I am today as far as my commitment to abstinence, abstaining from compulsive overeating, and recovery. And again, I didn't go into it, but if food was the only thing in my life, I would be on a diet. And diets have always failed me. It's a three-part program: emotional, spiritual, and physical. I do believe it. I take the steps all the time, and I don't have time to tell you about turning it over and trusting God, and that awareness that we get before we do an insane action once we are in recovery. And it's the squirrel trap story, and I won't have time for it. But it really has to do with a time that I did get. You get an awareness before you do an insane act. You have to determine what insane act is. You know, for me, it's compulsive overeating, though there are others. And the longer you are in recovery, I believe the longer you have that awareness, and it makes it not easier, but it gives you time before you do it so compulsively to turn it over to your higher power. So anyway, this person in the back of the room said, I intend to be abstinent one day at a time for the rest of my life. Because I didn't hear, I heard the earliest I got up, and but you know, for me, I adapted that. I it works for me because I can't think this thing ends. I need to keep my memory green. I can't believe for a minute I am a former compulsive overeater. Because if I believe that I am a former compulsive overeater, or completely cured, remember I'm incurable, then that's when I will become an active one. Is that 4 minutes or 3 minutes?
Four.
All right, squirrel shut, George. So I'm going to tell him. I had squirrels in the attic. And I tried to get rid of them. I borrowed a trap from somebody and I caught cardinals. I put it on the outside. And I did this and I did that. Finally, the person said to me, the only thing you can do is bait it, and I saw the entry was in the attic, and go up in the attic and put the trap there. Well, I baited it, and I baited it with something that I was told that they love, and it was something I loved, and the smell was like getting me, so I baited it, and I'm crawling up, and I'm in program, I'm in recovery, and I'm crawling up, and then also somebody said to me, be careful if you see the squirrel. They're very vicious. So I got that, like vicious squirrels, and I'm like, and it's getting narrow because the entrance that they were coming in was in the far end of the house in the attic, and they're like, look, and I go, oh, and I, what was that? And, you know, I'm like, go. So then I hadn't set the trap. I got to the point where I wanted to set it, and I went to set it, and I couldn't. Couldn't figure it out. Went to set it again, and I couldn't. I went to set it again, I couldn't. I'm getting angrier and angrier. And then a thought comes. I'm going to take this squirrel trap and I'm going to smash it, and I borrowed it. But I had a moment of clarity. I had an awareness that that's what I was going to do. It's beautiful. So what did I do? I took that squirrel trap, I threw it across the room, I screamed, I cursed, I went insane. I had the awareness, but I didn't have the willingness. I didn't have the willingness to turn it over to my higher power, who I choose to call God. You know, we get these gifts, but we have to act on them. It's awareness, acceptance, and then action. I did an insane act by going insane and screaming and cursing and throwing the trap that I borrowed. But I had the opportunity not to do it. But I took my will back and I did it. And in conclusion, I don't know what your story was before you walked into this room. I don't know if you ate compulsively. I don't know if you ate compulsively last night. I don't know if you ate compulsively this last week. I don't know if you're looking for your abstinence. I don't know if you're looking for your recovery. The simplest definition of abstinence is not eating compulsively, but not eating. I'm looking around. I don't see anybody eating. As far as I'm concerned, everyone in this room is abstinent. With all my heart, I hope you take that gift and keep it one day at a time for the rest of your lives. Thank you. I'm Tom.